Evernorth Health Services, we believe costs shouldn't get in the way of life-changing care. And we're doing everything in our power to make it possible. Behavioral health solutions that also keep your projections at their best? It's possible. Pharmacy benefits that benefit your bottom line? It's possible. Complex specialty care that cares about your ROI? It's possible. Because we're already doing it. All while saving businesses billions. That's Wonder made possible. Learn more at evernorth.com/wonder.
Your brain needs support, and new Ollie Brainy Chews are a delightful way to take care of your cognitive health. Made with scientifically backed ingredients like Thai ginger, L-theanine, and caffeine, Brainy Chews support healthy brain function and help you find your focus, stay chill, or get energized. Be kind to your mind and get these nootropic chews at Ollie.com. That's OLLY.com. These statements have not been evaluated by the Food and Drug Administration. This product is not intended to diagnose, treat, cure, or prevent any disease.
Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the editor of the New Books Network. NBN listeners like to read books and buy them. So we thought we'd tell you that right now, our friends at Princeton University Press are having a remarkable site-wide sale. You can get 50% off books, including ebooks and audiobooks, with the code 50, F-I-F-T-Y, at checkout until May 31. You can save some real money on Princeton University Press books. I encourage you to go there and check it out. Welcome to the New Books Network.
Hi, everyone. Welcome to the New Books Network. I'm your host, Tatiana Klepikova, and today my guest is Rustam Alexander, a Russian and Soviet historian. Rustam's new book, Gay Lives and Division Therapy in Brezhnev's Russia, 1964-1982, examines the autobiographies and diaries of Soviet homosexual men who underwent psychotherapy during the 1970s, 1980s, under the guidance of Jan Goland, a psychiatrist sexopathologist from Gorky. The examination of these unique and little-known documents contributes to our scant knowledge about the practices that many would call a Soviet prototype of aversion therapy. It also helps us understand the way homosexual people faced queer dilemmas of the self and how they sought to reconcile their queer desire with being Soviet. The book was published by Palgrave Macmillan in 2023, and I'm very excited to welcome you, Rustam, to the show.
Thank you, Tatiana. Thank you for inviting and having me. And I think the book was actually published in January 2024, somewhere during that time, December 2023 and or January 2024, but that's not something.
Yeah, right. Like, it's a very recent thing, and I was very excited to read it. So let's start by telling our listeners about yourself. What are you doing? How have you come to writing this book?
Well, I am, let's put it this way, I'm an early career researcher. I'm a historian. I'm a scholar. And obviously, I didn't write this book, you know, out of the blue. There was a chain of events that led me to do that. So in 2018, I finished my PhD in at the University of Melbourne in Australia, here in Sydney. The topic of my PhD was homosexuality in the Soviet Union, mainly the Khrushchev and Brezhnev periods. And then after completing my thesis, I wrote my first book, which is based entirely on my thesis. I mean, it was reworked, of course. It is titled Regulating Homosexuality in Soviet Russia, A Different History. Then a year later, I wrote another book, which is let's put it this way, a nonfiction version of my first book. And then this third book is basically a logical continuation of my research. And I wrote it in 2022. I think 2022, 2023. Yes. And that's how it came about.
Awesome. That's a very exciting body of work. And today we'll be digging into the aversion therapy part of it, which I'm very interested in, like, to find out about what actually aversion therapy meant in the context of the Soviet Union. What are you looking into in this book?
Well, to be honest, aversion therapy is a phrase that was never in the documents that I was working with. So aversion therapy is just a convenient label for English-speaking audiences, Western audiences, so that we can immediately contextualize what I was going to talk about. Yeah, obviously, by aversion therapy, I meant, by aversion therapy, I meant a set of practices, of medical practices, of trying to cure male homosexuality. So by calling it an aversion therapy, it was basically done for the sake of simplicity. Obviously, the term itself, aversion therapy, is a complex phenomenon, and it includes many, many different things. And in the Soviet context, it was something different. Yeah. So I was talking about the attempts of a doctor, of a prominent Soviet psychiatrist, Jan Golland, to cure homosexual men. And for the sake of simplicity, I just used this label. But if we're talking about medical practices of treating homosexual men, there were quite a few differences. So the first difference, at least in the case of this particular doctor, Jan Golland, is that he never relied on any medications or electroshock therapies or anything like that. So if you look at aversion therapies elsewhere in the world, there was always some sort of aggressive therapy, some sort of aggressive thing, drugs, shocks, all that kind of stuff. But when it came to Golland, he never used any drugs or anything like that. All he used was his words and his hypnosis, yeah, and the method that he called autogenic training, when a person was to repeat to themselves certain words and phrases that were supposed to help them get rid of their homosexual desire. And then also whereas in the West aversion therapies were based mainly on psychoanalytical theories and desires to dig into one's subconscious world. In the context of this doctor, there was no such attempt to investigate the past of the patient. It didn't really matter what happened in the past. The doctor wanted to know what happened in the past just to get a general understanding of what the patient was dealing with. But the treatment method itself was based on the principle of immediate jumping into action. So the patient was to deal with his impulses and desires on the spot without trying to understand what caused them in the past. So basically, a patient was to repeat himself, because I'm writing mainly about homosexual men, a set of phrases, self-hypnosis, autogenic training, self-suggestion. Yeah, and that was something that Golland hoped would help his patients. There were a couple of other differences, and all of them are described in my book, but I think the most important ones are the ones that I've just talked about. And actually, Golland himself, the doctor in question, he was very proud of the fact that he never caused any physical suffering to his patients. Obviously, he caused the mental suffering, but when it came to all these barbaric methods, he never employed any of these. And he was proud of that because he knew that in the Soviet Union, there were doctors, obviously not as famous and prominent as him, who actually tried to castrate their patients, who tried to give them some sort of harmful pills and medicines. And it never worked, of course. And then these patients somehow ended up in in Golland's consultation room. And Golland broke the amazing news to them, telling them that they can be cured without any aggressive medical intervention. So this is the nature of his treatment method in a nutshell.
Right. And it's fascinating to see this comparative lens of how the Soviet Union or this particular doctor, right, differed from the practices of the time. You mentioned already in your response the documents, right, that aversion therapy was never mentioned in the documents you worked with. Could you talk more about what kind of material you used to look into this story?
I basically came across these sources by accident. So I went to Nizhny Novgorod in 2017 as part of my PhD. I was at that time, I think I had written chapter one, chapter two, chapter three, and chapter four. And I was in a desperate need of chapter five and more material for chapter three. And honestly, I thought that I would never be able to finish my thesis because I just, didn't have enough sources to finish the, writing about the Brezhnev era. And then I just thought, okay, so what am I going to write about? And then again, I looked at Dan Healy's book, Homosexual Desire, and I looked at the conclusion for some sort of inspiration. And then I came across this name, Jan Gollancz. And I thought, okay, well, this guy must be still alive, certainly, And I Googled him and I found out that he was still, operating and treating people. And of course, he was still treating homosexual men. And I thought, well, there must be something in his office. There must be something in his archive or something like that. So I need to get in touch with him. So basically, when I was in Russia, I called him. And surprisingly, he invited me to his clinic. I went there. I explained to him that I was writing a thesis in Australia about him, about Golland, and about his medical treatment of various sexual disorders in the Soviet Union, which was true. I just didn't specify that I was particularly interested in homosexuality. And he was very kind, and he shared lots of stories. Of course, I conducted an interview with him, and then after our conversation, he just casually motioned towards his desk, and he said, "Have a look at these folders. There may be something there. I don't know. I'm just about to throw it away." And I thought, okay. So when he went about his business, I stayed in his office, and then I opened all these folders, which he allowed me to take a look at, and I was shocked. All of these were his patients' diaries from 1970s. Some of them were from the late 1960s. All of them were anonymized. Yeah, all of them were written under some sort of pseudonym, so I couldn't tell. I mean, there was nothing specific about these people, but there was everything there in terms of their biographies, like their problems, the course of treatment, and all of that stuff. So that's how I came about these sources. And then in the end, I thought that I would actually not need all these sources for my thesis. And I ended up not including them in my thesis. And I knew that at some point I would write a book about them because, these are amazing sources. They tell us about something that has been known in very, very sketchy terms. And now we know about all that stuff.
Right, and it's so amazing the story about coming across this host of documents that basically no researcher ever had an access to, and this doctor just giving you access to them. My question would be like, how did you select the sources you would include in the book? Because I can imagine there were many documents there that are extremely interesting. And also in your book, you mentioned that like many of these diaries and notes, even if anonymized, come from the patients themselves, or they were retyped by Golland in the process of working with these patients or after the therapy, and that there may have been an act of censorship involved, or like self-censorship by patients at the stage of writing. So how did you also work with this dilemma of approaching these documents that may or may not be a complete story in that sense?
Well, yes, of course. So first of all, of course, there was an element of self-censorship in them. I acknowledge that in the introduction of the book. Of course, writing about yourself in a diary, even anonymized, was not a very safe enterprise at that time because male homosexuality was still a crime. And technically, there was a lot of self-incriminating potential in these diaries and autobiographies. Not to mention the fact that the doctor was putting his whole life and practice in jeopardy too. because he could easily be accused of something indecent, misconduct, or disseminating pornography and stuff like that. So he was running a risk as well. And in terms of self-censorship and the completeness and the reliability of these sources, so first of all, yes, you're right. Patients wrote diaries and other things themselves, and then at some point, Golland retyped them. He typed them up in documents, basically for his collection of testimonials, which he then showed to his future patients, who were supposed to get some sort of inspiration from them. And of course, at this stage, Golland could have embellished some of the outcomes of his treatment. That's what he wanted in the end. He wanted his patients to be cured. But what I'm looking in this book is not whether his treatment methods worked or not. Yeah, I mean, we all understand, I think, that they didn't. What I'm looking at is the stories, is other aspects, yeah, other dimensions of the Soviet gay experience during the Brezhnev era. Yeah, for example, the places where they met, the way they communicated, the way they met one another, the way they had sex, the spaces that they found for having sex, where this homosexual activity took place. And all these sources, they tell us a lot about that period. And again, in general, in terms of the overall reliability, all of the practices, all of the things described in these diaries and autobiographies, they are very, very similar to those described by scholars elsewhere. For example, Dan Healy's article, chapter Moscow, yeah, so, and his other work. So they are very similar to these, to the things that he described. And that made me believe that overall, they communicated very well. I mean, overall, they were pretty reliable. And again, of course, some patients, they could have made things up, again, in terms of the outcome of the treatment. But since most of them genuinely wanted to be helped, they were quite candid about what they were writing. And they are writing, so when they were writing by their hand, was not, it was not carefully curated. You could see that there was there were thoughts in their head, and some of them didn't make any sense. By typing all these things up, Golland just wanted them apparently to be neat and presentable. So how I selected them? Well, I selected those which were, I mean, there were many, many documents. The problem was that some of them were, they didn't have, any sort of beginning. They didn't have any sort of ending. They were very fragmented. Sometimes it was difficult to put them all together. There were no page numbers. You'd have to, there was a lot of sort of like guessing and working through and finding out, like, so they were not neatly put together in a diary. So those stories that I was able to put together and put in at least some sort of chronological order, and basically when I was very confident that that's the same diary, I was confident. So then I basically chose these ones. Of course, there are some other, so in some cases we had many, many, I had many, there were many sources where Golland's patients were just describing how they were trying to cure themselves. So there was no, autobiography, let's put it this way. Yeah, but there were these technical descriptions. Okay, today I'm not thinking about women. Okay, today I'm thinking about, I'm not thinking about men. I'm not thinking about men. And they were quite repetitive. So I decided not to include them because we understand. I mean, I described already in detail how Golland, how the whole system of his techniques worked. But in terms of the reliability, I was very, 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 I was worried about that at the start, but then after doing careful research and, you know, some contextualization, before writing this book, I wrote an article, Taming the Desire, the bisexual closet of Pavel Krotov. So that was my first test of these sources. And the peer reviewers, huge thanks to them, they gave me some very valuable suggestions. And that's what basically inspired me to write, because their suggestions were very good. And thanks to their suggestions, I was able to frame it in a scholarly way and, you know, find some convenient analytical lens. So, and one of the reviewers also mentioned the fact that, yes, some people could say that these sources are not reliable, but apparently it fits really well into the known narrative about what, you know, what we know, even though we know very little about the private lives of homosexual men in the 1970s. So basically, this is how I worked with these sources.
Well, let's dig more into the characters of this incredible narrative within the known narrative. I would love to start with Goland. Like, who is this guy? Where did he come from? How did he come to treat homosexual men with his aversion therapy? And what did this aversion therapy entail, right? Because you mentioned in your book this autogenic training. You also mentioned it already in the interview. He also had this socio-psychological vacuum. Could you speak more about this very particular methods, which were, in his opinion, non-invasive?
Mm-hmm. Yes, obviously they were invasive. Psychologically, he was basically destroying them. I mean, again, he kind of framed it as if his patients wanted it. But I guess that's a different issue that is worth exploring. So back to your question about where he came from. So Goland, he was born in the city of Gorky. He apparently, his parents were psychiatrists. And then at some point in his life, in his early 30s, in 1960-61, I think, he met a psychiatrist whose name was Nikolai Ivanov, who was dealing with sexual disorders, impotence, and also homosexuality. And apparently at that period of his life, Goland became fascinated by this person, and he asked Ivanov to become his mentor. And Ivanov took him on as a trainee, and Goland shadowed all of his activities, and then including the treatment of homosexuality. And then in 1965, Ivanov suffered a stroke, and he was no longer able to work with his patients. So he handed over his patients to Goland, including five or four homosexual patients who were, you know, about to, well, no, no, who were still on their way to becoming heterosexual. So that's how, and that's when Goland started. These were Goland's first patients. And then once they became heterosexual, Goland wrote his first scientific article. He started presenting at conferences. And then apparently, as he was presenting at conferences, his colleagues were getting to know him better, and they were sending him their patients from all the remote parts of the Soviet Union. But basically, by becoming, you know, known among his colleagues, he was also becoming known among those people, those men who wanted to get some sort of help, yeah, who wanted to fit into the society that they were living in by becoming heterosexual. So, and Goland, I think in the early 1970s, in 1972, actually, to be more exact, he published his elaborate description of his treatment method, which consisted of three steps. So the first step was to help patients achieve a so-called sexual psychological vacuum, which is basically a state of asexuality, when you are not attracted neither to men or women. And so this state of mind Golland was hoping to achieve by, well, basically a patient was to achieve by autogenic training. So basically the patient would repeat a set of phrases to himself, something like, I'm not attracted to men anymore, I'm into women now, I'm not looking at men anymore, yeah, and so on. Then patients would force themselves to look at women instead of men. They would not allow their, you know, to stare at, they would not allow themselves to stare at men. Instead, they would force themselves to stare at women and all of that stuff. So, and Golland hoped that at some point his patients would reach this state when they don't want men or women. And so basically, apparently, after some time, Golland would give his patients a questionnaire where they would have to demonstrate that they are indeed asexual. So, and in this questionnaire, there were questions like, are you finally able to, something along the lines, yeah, I'm finally able to say that your sexual desire towards men diminished. So basically, it was all positive stuff, yeah, and patients had no chance to say, sorry, the treatment is not working. And I think they didn't say anything like that, yeah, even though they could feel that something was not working, they still wanted to, or they were perhaps scared of telling him the truth, telling Golland the truth that the treatment is not working. So basically, all of them said, yes, everything is fine, everything is working, we're feeling it, and he would allow them then to proceed to part number two. So part number two of the treatment method was about it was about looking at women's pictures. Yeah, these were Renaissance women from you know, the 17th or 18th, 14th, 15th century, voluptuous women. And Golland would show the reproduction of these paintings to his patients, and he would teach his patients to appreciate the beauty of a female body, because Golland believed that deep inside, homosexual men were just hating women. So it was important to help them get rid of this hatred. And at that stage, the patient was also expected to do some sort of homework, try and meet women, and try to sort of like spend time with them. And then again, there would be a questionnaire with questions. Hey, is everything working? And the patients would say yes. And then finally, stage three, the nudity in these paintings of Renaissance women would be more explicit. And at this stage, Golland would be giving specific advice to his patients on how to date women, and eventually would help them basically have sexual intercourse with them, which would be the most positive outcome, you know, the most positive sign that the treatment is actually working. And of course, I can imagine that by stage three, some of his patients, most of his patients, I think, were tired. I think they realized that nothing was working, but still they were saying that, yes, it's working. Now I'm finally behaving like a man. Yeah, because one of the complaints that some of his patients voiced was that their behavior, that they were ridiculed, for example, at work, yeah, or at school, for their effeminate behavior, and they wanted to get rid of that. And part of Golan's therapy was asking his, well, making his patients go to the gym. Yeah, or for example, you know, to exercise, to, you know, to learn how to dance. So all of that stuff that I think had little to do with their sexual orientation. So essentially Golland was trying to do was to make their behavior heterosexual, but of course it didn't change the very nature of their sexual desire. So, but again, in my book, I was not interested in the outcomes. I was interested in the process, in the journey. Yeah. So all of the stuff that they revealed is quite illuminating. And the fact that they, described all of these things from the first person is just, I think something, I mean, there's nothing like that in the existing scholarship. And interestingly, yes, I mean, in Red Closet, I did describe some of these episodes, but this, my third book is, just about this aspect of Golan's treatment, and all of the characters in the book, not characters, yeah, all of the patients, yeah, all of the people who underwent this therapy, they were telling about themselves from the first person. And I think you asked me who they were, yeah, who they were. There was a, yeah.
Right,
you
right.
To.
Yeah, let's dig into the patients, because, like, I think at this point everybody was so, who were these men who were coming to Golan, and especially like about the fact that men, right, also homosexual men that were finding him.
Yes, he did mention, Golan did mention to me that he was actually treating female homosexuality as well, but I didn't have any hard evidence about that kind of treatment. And also he had a huge thick file on treating transsexuality in the 1980s, but this file didn't make sense at all. So there were, like, I mean, it was handwritten, nothing was typed up, so it was just, I just couldn't wrap my head around it, honestly. But in terms of the people whom I include in the book, so the first was a young man of, I think he was 21 years old. And so basically I talk about him in my chapter 2 and 3, because that was the most comprehensive file. He had an elaborate autobiography and elaborate diary where he described the course of his treatment. And that was, I mean, that file was very rich in all sorts of descriptions, all sorts of details, all sorts of things and contexts. Yeah, so this person tells us about his very, 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 eventful homosexual life at school, and all of these things were consensual. And and then he was telling us about his experiences at the university, various men, cruising spaces like public toilets, then homophobia, how, for example, he had to pretend that he was not homosexual when he was listening to his classmates at the university ridiculing another guy who was supposedly homosexual, all sorts of things. He was very elaborate, and I think that's because he was from a family of a doctor. So it was the upper class, and he had a library at home. His father had a library at home, and that's how he found out what homosexuality was. One day, he overheard a conversation of his father with other doctors who were invited for dinner, and they were discussing that. And then he describes this interesting episode when he comes to his dad and he says, "Father, what does it mean, homosexuality?" And his father says, "These people are freaks." Yeah, and this man, he had to pretend that he was asking that because a friend of his asked him to ask that. And so all of that stuff is quite interesting. And yes, the fact that this man, this young man, he is very elaborate and verbose, and his writing is quite sophisticated, I would say. It's all indicative of his status within of the status of his family. Yeah, doctors, quite well educated, family, and it was all shaped. It was all because his family, was educated, and they basically, how can I put this in language? So the upper class, basically. Then we have, what I like about this book actually is that these people, they were coming from different regions, and they were representing different, they were from all walks of life. So the second person was a man from the, I think from the Republic. Well, the second one, yeah. So the first one that I discussed was from the city of Orenburg, I think. The second was from the Crimean Peninsula, somewhere in that region. He didn't specify where exactly, but he was living on the seaside. So his experience was very different. He was telling in his diary that in summer he would have many homosexual encounters because there would be many people coming to that area to have, you know, to like to resorts and so on. And then in winter he would get depressed because there would be nobody there. So this second person, he was talking a lot about his family, about the fact that his family found out about his lovers and how his family was trying to accept him and how he tried to reconcile his life with the fact that his family now knew that he was homosexual. And he didn't want to abandon his family because he was emotionally attached to them. So there was this complex, you know, overlap of things that was quite similar to the experiences described by Francesca Stella and her and the women, the lesbian women from you know, from her book, Lesbian
Lesbian Lives in Soviet Russia.
Yes,
right?
yeah, in Soviet Russia, yes. That's something that I thought was striking as well. And the third person who I'm talking about was a man from the Suvorov military school. So you can imagine what kind of education he got and how this militarized masculinity framed him. And so he's telling us about his civil life, how he was trying to make himself attracted to women. Then he was trying to, you know, to have a sexual intercourse with women, but they felt that by his own admission that he was not man, enough of a man. And then one day he finally got married, so he found a woman, and then he still continued to meet men. And what I like about this chapter, like my favorite part, is his forays into the gay Moscow, how he would go there on his business trips and how he would explore. First, he was kind of scared. During his second trip, he finally found someone. So all of that, all of these adventures are described in this book. And actually, I talked about them in the Red Closet as well. Then the final chapter is about a man who comes from the, apparently, who comes from the Soviet countryside. So his experiences were quite different too. What is interesting is that he actually never, ever used the word homosexual. Never. He would, you know, he would use all sorts of euphemism, but he was not comfortable with that. He would call himself a deficient person. He would call himself like he would hint at his feminine, sort of effeminate behavior. Yeah, the fact that he was never able to, you know, to meet, to befriend a woman, or a young woman, and to have sex with her. So this is also something that I thought was striking, because all Golan's patients, they used the word homosexuality at some points of their, you know, of their narratives, but this person never did. And so these are, I think so, 1, 2, 3, 4 men whose stories were more or less complete. So they were basically in the book.
And how do they assess the treatment? What is their progress with the therapy that Goland offers to them? And how did they seek him out?
So the first man, the 20, like the young one, the youngest one. So he was first. I mean, when he realized that he wanted to get some medical treatment, he found a local doctor. And the local doctor tried to hypnotize him and do all sorts of things on him. And then they realized that nothing was working. So this local doctor referred him to the Department of Sexopathology in Moscow, which was just, I mean, which had recently, you know, been inaugurated. So that's how he went there. And again, we can see the indications of the upper class sort of thing, because he flies to Moscow with his father. Yeah, so, and they stay at some sort of hotel there. Yeah, that kind of stuff. So that's how he found Goland. The second guy, that's not very clear. Yes, so I couldn't find anything on that, how he found Goland. So this second person, he was doing research, yeah, and he was talking to doctors and he was talking to his friends. And I think that by word of mouth, yeah, he came to know about Goland. And then the guy from the Suvorov Military School, I'm not sure. That's something I think I didn't have anything on. And then the guy from the countryside, again, I can't, yeah. So this episode was absent about how they came across him. But I think maybe it's possible that they could have learned about his practices from their, you know, contacts or something. So yeah, in some cases, this episode is missing. And in terms of the progress, so the first guy, I think, even though the folder with his files says that he was discharged 6 months later, the last episode in his diary describes his relapse. When he goes to the public, he goes to a park, he meets a man, and they immediately have sex in the bushes. And that's it, basically. So he relapsed, and apparently something happened, and then he was discharged. So we don't know if the treatment worked. The second one, again, I could find the autobiography, but I couldn't find I didn't have the diary describing the course of the treatment. Then the military man, he again, yeah, in the case of this military man, there were some descriptions of how he tried to get treatment, but I couldn't find anything on the outcome. But the last one, the one from the countryside, he had elaborate descriptions in his diary about how he had sex with the woman, even though he said that it didn't give him pleasure, but he managed to do that. And in some, in the beginning, he was kind of, so a year later, he was saying, look, even though I haven't had sex with any female person, I can feel that the treatment is working. So that was basically just his words, yeah? And I think, finally he got married, and to the best of my recollection, and I think he did manage to have sex at least once with a woman. Yeah, I think so. So yeah, the outcomes were very modest, but Goland framed all of them as success stories. And as I write in my first book, he actually encouraged his patients to go to conferences with him. He would put on heavy makeup on their faces and, you know, glasses and hats, and they would talk to the audience about their newly acquired heterosexuality. Some doctors were very skeptical about that. Well, some doctors believed that Goland could treat homosexuality, and that's why they sent their patients to him eventually. So it worked in his favor.
Wow. I mean, I would love to know more about a broader picture of a society where it is possible that a guy like Goland starts this kind of therapy, and also people would come to him and be writing and talking openly in some way about their sexuality and sexual life. And then there would be all these conferences where they would go together with him and like talk about this experience. So could you tell us more about how sexopathology and sexology as a science developed in the Soviet Union in the Brezhnev era, which you choose as the scene for your book?
Yeah. So science of sexopathology, yeah, the sexological science itself, it almost ceased to exist under Stalin, yeah, from the 1930s and up to the 1960s. There was no such profession as a sexologist who could actually help Soviet people to deal with their sexual disorders, which were on the rise. So in the early 1960s, a group of doctors from Moscow realized that something must be done. There are too many letters from bereaved Soviet people, men and women, telling about their sexual problems, the fact that they couldn't have a fulfilling sexual life, that their marriage was on the brink of collapse, and there was nowhere they could seek help. So a group of doctors decided to organize a series of conferences for aspiring sexologists. And at these conferences, the first conference happened in 1963 in the city of Gorky, by the way, where Goland and his mentor, Professor Ivanov, were based. And so following these three initial conferences, these doctors apparently convinced the Minister of Health to allocate some funding towards the inauguration of some sort of sexopathological center in Moscow. And in 1965, such center was opened. And that was basically a milestone achievement. That was basically the beginning of Soviet era sexopathology. The center was quite modest. It was basically just, a couple of offices, yeah, as part of the one Moscow psychiatric hospital, but the demand for sexual services for the treatment of sexual disorders was huge. There were many. Again, it was not the opening of the center was not advertised, but somehow the doctors at the center, and there were like three or four of them, they ended up receiving tons of letters and stories of problems. So basically, I think at some point that they realized that direct referrals, I mean, they introduced some sort of, this is something that I actually don't mention in my book. I mentioned that in my new book, which I wrote in the Russian language, which is called There Was Sex in the USSR. They realized that the demand for that sort of, for these sort of services was so huge that they limited the number of patients from regions because they physically could not attend, to all the patients who wanted to see them. And then this sexological science was slowly developing. Of course, it was very, very, very underdeveloped. Sexology in Czechoslovakia was far more sophisticated. Sexology in the GDR was far more sophisticated. Obviously, Igor Korn described Soviet sexology or sexopathology as an outcast because Soviet officials didn't think that it was necessary. They thought that sexology, sexological health, sexual health, people's sexual health was not a problematic thing. That all people were healthy. Also, people were sexually healthy per se. They didn't need any help. So there was a lot of enthusiasm. There was a lot of selfless sort of desire to help people on the part of these doctors. And they were not paid anything. So they were doing all of that for free. Yeah, because they were faithful and truthful to their profession, and they just wanted to help people. And then slowly in the 1970s, there were other sexological centers in other Soviet cities. When I say centers, I'm not talking about like a huge institution. No, that was something very modest. And then other doctors, yeah, they... So basically by the 1980s, sexological help was accessible, but you could still, you would still have to go some sort of extra mile to get there. Yeah, it was not accessible in small towns. Yeah, it was basically accessible in major cities, in big cities. Well, at least something. And part of these sexological services, yeah, entailed treating homosexuality. Yeah, so Goland was, I think, the most prominent. He was basically a celebrity, you know, compared to many other doctors. But I'm sure that there were still quite a few doctors who treated homosexuality and whose practices are still unknown to us. 100%.
And this is where I guess the new project comes in. I mean, an exciting story about a field we know so little about. And now you mentioned this, there was sex in the USSR book. So could you tell us more as a means of wrapping up this interview about what are you working on? What is in that book? And what other projects are in the pipeline for you?
Well, to be honest, I am working on several projects at the moment, but that is the most the priority one, because it was supposed to be published in May and it's already May. So basically we're in the final stages of well, putting this book together. It's called There Was Sex in the USSR. And again, it's a book written in the Russian language with the individual books. And this is a book which talks about sex life of Soviet people in a very accessible form through their individual stories, and starting from basically starting from the moment when the Soviet Union came into existence and ending, yeah, with the collapse of the Soviet Union. And I really hope that this book will come out in a couple of weeks. Yeah, each chapter is devoted to different sides of different stories, basically, including the way Soviet people try to find some sort of solution to their sexual problems. Yeah, and these stories are fascinating. They tell us a lot. Even though this book is not academic strictly, yeah, it's still based on sources. I mean, it's not strictly academic because it doesn't have any sort of academic, like narrow academic argument. And some of the things that I talk about in this book, they are not new for most scholars, yeah, but for the general, for the audience outside academic circles, scholarly circles in Russia, and considering what is happening in Russia now, that will be eye-opening, I think. And I really hope it will. Well, one of the issues, for example, I talk about is abortion. Yeah, so I think some time ago it was a very hot topic because there was a possibility that abortions would be banned. It never happened, thank God. And yeah, so I'm very looking forward to seeing this book out. Hopefully no negative consequences will follow.
I can't wait to read that one. So thank you, Rustam, for coming on the show. I wish you good luck with this book and with many other projects that you're working on. And have a wonderful day.
Thank you, Tatiana. You too. Bye-bye, everyone.